We'll get started. Good evening, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School. And I'm your schoolmaster, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine. And do note the complimentary copy of, not the latest issue, but the one before it, and a complimentary copy of Books Ireland, and a complimentary bag, which are a very sought-after item these days. So if you feel overwhelmed by guilt at this generosity, you know, do consider taking out a subscription. Because while this event is subsidised, the magazine itself isn't. It relies on no subvention whatsoever, except from you, the reader. Which is why we're able to print all that, you know, interesting, marvellous stuff without fear or favour. Now, tonight's discussion, this year, of course, marks the... we are currently going through the decade of centenaries, or some people call it one damn thing after another. And of course, the big one this year is the millennium of the Battle of Clontarf. And this is the second of the two head schools we've had on that topic. But of course, no discussion of Brian Brew would be complete without him being discussed in his own locality where he's from. And it's great to be here in Killaloo. So, this year marks the millennium of East Clare's most famous warrior. And of course, I'm not referring to Keith Wood, the owner of this establishment, a more recent East Clare warrior. But of course, what we'd like to discuss here is, you know, how did Brian Brew emerge from the relative obscurity of East Clare? By the way, I'm not implying that East Clare is obscure. Just to make that clear. The relative obscurity of East Clare. Was he really Imperator Scotorum, Emperor of the Irish, as is famously written on the Book of Armagh, or was he just another local warlord whose wider dominance was fleeting? Here to discuss this tonight, I have on my right Professor Sean Duffy from Trinity College, Pat Wallace, former director of the National Museum, and from the University of Limerick, Cathy Swift. Now, oh, by the way, just for those of you who haven't been at any head schools before, don't relax too much because, of course, you, the audience, are meant to participate. So, you know, if you have any questions at any stage, just put your hand up. It won't just be a few questions at the end. So, you know, just be ready to jump in whenever the spirit moves you. And we have a radio mic. We have a radio mic there for that purpose. And, of course, this is all being recorded, so, you know, keep it clean, you know, whatever contribution you make. Sean, I want to start with you. Now, obviously, we're keen to discuss the local context here of Brian Brew, but could you just zoom out a little bit first and give us the wider picture, in other words, the political structure of Ireland at that time, in particular, the whole question of kingship, whether it be high kingship or provincial kingships. Were they real, in other words?
Right. Not an easy one, Tommy.
I always start me off with a hard one.
It's going to get easier as the night goes on. I don't know if you can hear me down the back. I mean, it's a difficult one. It is the case that most Irish people nowadays are Republicans. But in the past, we were fierce royalists, you know, and Ireland, of course, didn't just have a king. It had a plurality of kings. It had loads of kings. I mean, and it's impossible to know exactly how many kings. But at any one time, there might have been 150 or so people in Ireland who claimed the title of king, kings at a local level, who might have ruled an area that was the size of a modern barony, a division of a county. And above them, again, there was a rank of kings who ruled an area maybe the size of a county or a diocese. In fact, the modern dioceses were based on kingdoms that existed in the 12th century when the dioceses were formed at that time. And above them, again, there were kings at a provincial level. And in the past, there were more than four provinces in Ireland. Obviously, as you know, the Irish for a province is Cúige, which means a fifth. So there were five provinces. And at some point, there was a pentarchy as well, at least a fabled pentarchy. And a heptarchy, we've no idea exactly how many provinces, because they fluctuated over time in accordance with, you know, the vicissitudes of war and so on. And above them as well, there was an idea of a high king. You know, I mean, I sometimes meet people who tell me there was no such thing as a high king in medieval Ireland, but there is that idea, it is there. Dan Binchy, who's the man who famously edited the Brehon Laws, I think he was the one who claimed first there was no such thing as a high king, because it isn't specifically described as a reality in the law tracts, the early Irish Brehon laws. But they do, in marginal entries and so on in them, they do refer to the idea of a high king. And of course, that very idea of Ireland being divided into cúigeas, you know, fifths, implies that there is a whole of which they are a part. So there was a high kingship. It was something that was taken very seriously, and people did fight and died trying to get to the top. So you have, in other words, you have all these lower-ranking kings, each competing to become a king slightly higher up the ladder, and then ultimately these provincial kings are trying to make it, the half dozen or so top kings, to make it, to claim this concept of the high kingship. And that is the thing that had been dominated for a couple of centuries, certainly 200, 300 years, by a dynasty called the Í Néill, who originated in the northern half of the island. It doesn't mean that they ruled all Ireland, but they claimed to be kings of Tara, to have this kingship of Tara, and therefore by virtue of possessing the title King of Tara, they claimed they could be kings throughout all Ireland. And that's why, I mean, we'll talk a lot about Brian Boru later on, but that's why he was such an original person. You know, he's not, I sometimes meet people who tell me that he mustn't have existed. He might, you know, he's a figment of people's imagination like a fairy tale. But he was a very significant political figure, and, you know, his main political significance, leaving aside altogether whatever the Battle of Clontarf might have been about in 1014, his main political significance is that having come from the ranks of these lesser kings, he did manage to push his way up to the top and to oust the Í Néill from their high kingship of Ireland and to be a new kind of, to lodge a new kind of a high kingship in the country that lasted for the next 150 years or so until the Anglo-Normans invaded in 1169.
So would you say that the high kingship, such as it existed, you know, pre-Norman, was a creation of Brian Boru, to that extent?
Well, I mean, Cathy probably would disagree with most of what I'm saying, but
Let the woman speak for herself. Cathy, do you disagree away if you want to, just on what Sean said there?
No.
She's not disagreeing right now. I tell you what, I'm going to go to Cathy anyway, because what I want to do is, Sean's given us the sort of wide angle picture. Just want to zoom in then on this locality, right? Because obviously this is where Brian Boru is from, and you keep this term, you know, relative obscurity comes up. You know, how obscure was it, and you know, how can we account for the rise of this remarkable man from this allegedly obscure area?
Well, I mean, one of the really interesting things about Brian Boru, I mean, you talked about him as Emperor of the Irish or Imperator Scotorum, was he Emperor of Clare? There's actually relatively little information about how he's ruling in this area. But as far as we know, the family is really concentrated in this area of East Clare, and of course in Ballina as well. And when himself and his brother are young, they're going across to Utna or Aoni, the graves of the Leinster, and that sort of area, and they're hiding from the Vikings who are moving up and down the Shannon.
Right.
And we tend to think of him just as a Clare king, but actually, the family in as Brian is growing up are fighting in central Clare. They don't actually control central Clare, and there's very little evidence that they ever control West Clare to any great extent. Or at least, if they control it, they're controlling it through alliances with the kings of West Clare.
So they did hurling, not football. Well, that was way over your head.
Yeah, it was. Actually, yeah. Sorry, I was bewildered by that one. But
West Clare, East Clare.
Yeah. Okay. Right. That's one thing. What actual? And then the other issue is that the genealogies of Brian, as we have them, are written after Brian has become important and after his family have created this really strong kingdom of Thomond, which includes East Limerick. So we have a situation where a lot of our information about the family says that they're controlling all of East Limerick down as far as the Galtees, as well as parts of Tipperary and Clare. Is that true? Was it true in Brian's day, or is it true simply after Brian had created the family fortunes, as it were, and had put them on the road to glory? And the real answer, I think, I don't know what other people feel, is that we don't know, realistically. There's been a tendency to say that because the information is in genealogies, it has to be accurate. But the genealogies are, for the most part, written long after Brian himself. And so it does make for a mystery.
Catherine, just push it back a little bit, though, because it seems to me that Brian Boru, he sits on the shoulders of others, like his brother and his father. I mean, how far back should we push the thing in terms of looking for the rise of this what would become this powerful dynasty? Who's the main guy, like, who starts it off?
Well, if you look at Brian's dad has a daughter that he marries to the king of Midha. And Midha is Westmeath and Meath. It's these Midlands from the Shannon to the sea, okay, the Irish Sea. And at that stage, Midha is one of the provinces, as it were, that Sean was talking about. In the early part of the 10th century, the two counties, as it were, Westmeath and Meath, are very closely aligned. The ruling families are intermarrying all the time. And Brian's dad, Kenedig, manages to marry off a daughter.
That shows tremendous ambition, though, and all, some sort of strategic thinking, obviously, to marry to marry your daughter to the high king.
Certainly, the most powerful king in the most powerful family in the Midlands of Ireland of the day. So clearly, and in Brian's father's day, Clare people are ambitious.
She wasn't very
successful.
Clever lady, you're being very delicate there, Cathy.
Being delicate,
her name was Orla, and she had a relationship then with the High King's, and in the presence of children, a relationship with the High King's son, her own stepson, which caused the High King then to have her executed, put to death. That stage. That's the first appearance, I think, on record of one of Brian's siblings, and it's a fairly inglorious end.
Can I just throw something in here? Were these guys, I know Brian, his brother, his father, were they lucky that they seem to live a long time? Longevity,
I mean, some of his siblings died quite young.
All right, okay.
Congal of Cumhmelmithig of Naus, he comes down and he raids on Loch Derg, and he kills off two of his Brian's brothers, and there's another one, Lochna, who dies quite young. So, but there's a lot of them. There's a lot of kids.
There's a big gene pool there.
Exactly.
They do in the family, those who manage to survive to adulthood, and they do tend to live to a very big age. I mean, we don't know what age Brian was when he died. Some sources say that he was born in 941, which would make him 73 at the time the Battle of Clontarf. Others say he was well into his 80s. And his son Donacha, who succeeded him, was old enough to be of fighting age at the time of the Battle of Clontarf in 1014, and then eventually died in Rome in 1064. He's buried in Rome in the church of San Stefano al Rotondo. Because if you're ever in Rome, you can see the plaque marking his burial place. But I mean, if he was old enough to fight, to be able to fight at the Battle of Clontarf in 1014, but only to die in 1064, he must have been well into his 80s then, and also.
But that's twice the kind of the life expectancy.
It must have been on the age of time, yes.
Pat, I want to bring you in here because, we looked at the wider political situation, a little bit of the local, but into this comes the Vikings, right, and Limerick in particular. I mean, what sort of impact does that have, and how does it change over time in terms of the Gaelic polity or polities?
Well, the initial impact of the Vikings is the raiding and slaving and all of that. But Limerick Limerick would have been founded fairly early on. I mean, Dublin is 840, 41. The very interesting site of Woodstock and Waterford is probably that time. And certainly the so-called Loomforts, those are the first Viking settlements in Ireland, semi-permanent settlements. They are from the 840s. There's a very important one in Loch Ney as well, but which I don't think we have found archaeologically. But the nearest one to here, the nearest important one, is Limerick. Now, Limerick is very important archaeologically, or potentially, in that Limerick is the first Viking town in Ireland to have been taken over by the Irish, by Brian Boru and his lot, in fact by his brother, at the Battle of Solcoed in 967. So from 967, Limerick was under, it was in Irish hands. Dublin was not in Irish hands fully until about 1052, I think. So it's almost a century later. So if we were able to monitor the archaeology of Limerick properly, we'd not, because the preservation of Limerick in terms of Viking archaeology is hopeless. It's very bad. But there's a scholar there called Brian Hodgkinson who's doing wonderful work on maps, streets, every kind of clue that he can piece together. And he has done a remarkable job, Brian Hodgkinson, on pre-Norman Limerick. And even though there have been some excavations there, the Type 1 house, which is the diagnostic house of the Vikings in Ireland, in their towns, has not been found in Limerick, whereas that is the typical dwelling of the Viking, the Hiberna Norse town, or the Hiberna Scandinavian town. That has been found not only in Dublin, not only in Wexford, not only in Waterford, but even in Cork, which is only a semi Viking town. There's a lot of Gaelic influence more. But Limerick should have those, and in fact there are descriptions of fighting in Limerick and on the streets and all of that. The literary references to the actual topography and character of Viking Limerick are good, but the archaeology is poor. But it's enormously important historically, and connecting here with this part of Clare, or what's now called Clare, the family of Brian Boru would have dominated Limerick from an early date. But what's very interesting, I find, about the history of County Limerick and that region around it, is that how slow some of the local tribes, if that's what they are, what are they? Jeez, that seems worse.
They have kings, they're for their kingdoms.
Yeah, but it's worse.
Well, what does tribe mean?
No, let me tell you.
Right, okay, fine.
Take the Ebigenta, and some of those other kingdoms, if you don't mind, they did not comply with Brian Boru and his family, and they did not give up easily, particularly in Western Limerick. They remained difficult for Brian to control, as far as I know. And so the Mahon, Brian's brother, the Kennedy father, Mahon and Brian found it hard enough, I'd say, to control some of the kingdoms, particularly of the estuary and what's now called West Limerick area. They found it easy enough to do it in Limerick, and in fact, Lindsay, your lecture in Dublin, the one great thing about that lecture was it showed that, well, there were several, but it was the opening up of that corridor down towards what's now Kilmallock and East Limerick and over into the Galtees and Tipperary. That was the great thing about that link, that territory, as Cathy has already said, was easily enough dominated by Brian Boru and his family. And what's even more difficult to fathom is how Brian and his family conquered and dominated Cashel, the provincial capital, with the great Omagh dynasty. That would have been extraordinarily difficult to do, and yet they managed to do it.
I don't know what that is. Since the Munster Bind is tomorrow, you know, let's talk about Munster.
No.
Tomorrow is
the holy one. The real.
Oh, you see. Oh, yeah. No.
And this is one of the things that's interesting about Brian's family, obviously, because their origins seem to lie in the Limerick Clare area, whereas the Munster had been dominated, as Pat said, by this dynasty called the Oganachta, who are the southern equivalent of the Enil, who dominate the northern half of Ireland. But I mean, it seems to be the case that they were splintering and they were going into decline. The kings of Munster, before Brian's family emerged on the scene, they're very insignificant figures. So you know, there's barely a mention of them in the sources. Now, our sources are limited enough. But it can be very tricky even to establish the genealogy of of these people, what their lines of descent. So Munster seems to have been, it's like, rather than being one dynasty, it was a big confederation of dynasties who were all distantly related to each other. So there wasn't any concentration of power in one family. And this is one thing that's very noticeable about the Enail. You have the two branches of that, the southern Enail in the Midlands, and the northern Enail, they're up in Derry and Tyrone and Donegal. And they alternate the kingship between the kingship of Tara between the two of them very regularly. It's a very formalized kind of a thing. And very frequently, even within the northern Enail and within the southern Enail, the descent, it seems to be almost by, and probably by, primogeniture, from father to son, generation after generation, unless one of them has a mishap. But if you turn them to Munster, it's all over the place, and it's hopping back and forth in a very irregular pattern between these different branches of the Oganacht, of whom there are about a dozen of them that we know of. So I think what happened was that, and it may have been, I suppose, because the Vikings, if you think about the Viking bases in Ireland, there are none of them, none of the successful ones, are in the lands that were dominated by the Enail. If you look at the Viking towns from Dublin, along down the coast, Arklow and Wicklow and Wexford and then Waterford and then Cork and then Limerick, they're all in the area, in the southern half of Ireland. And that must have had some kind of destabilizing effect on the polity. And that must explain maybe why it is that Brian's family were able to make this break and, you know, reach into the stratosphere, if you like. But in hindsight, it was a mistake for the Enail to prevent the Vikings from establishing military camps, because the military camps became trading bases and the trading bases became towns. And, you know, towns are the engine of growth and of change, as Pat has shown, you know, in his work over the years. The Viking towns in Ireland are what brought Ireland into the European mainstream. And because they had these towns in the southern half of Ireland, and because Brian's family came to dominate first Limerick and then Waterford, and then Brian himself came to control Dublin to a large extent, that's what gave him this launching pad then for power throughout the entire island.
One of the other things, maybe one of the weaknesses in the Oganacht of Cashel, is the taxation system, because there's tax on the rents that they get from all the tributary kingdoms. It says very specifically, you don't tax your relatives. Well, if you have large groups of Oganacht, at least four or five of them sharing the kingship, and you're not taxing any of them, you're immediately weakening your ability to gather together an army. Yeah? Whereas the Dalgash, Brian's family, are quite happy to tax Limerick once they conquer it. And so they have a steady, as it were, income stream, which is very different from the situation of the Oganacht, which again perhaps helps to get to indicate why they're stronger in the end.
That anticipates my question to some extent, Cathy, right? Because what I want to focus in on is the significance of Limerick and also of Viking ships, right? Now, did the Irish have ships before the Vikings? Let's have a really dumb question here. Because you get the impression that nobody got into a boat until the Vikings arrived.
I'm taking this. Because I love Cathy so much, I'm taking this, right? Now, can I just say that there were no... I'd love to give you a talk on the ship in Europe from the year 400 onwards. The fact is, there were ships in Ireland before the Vikings. We have the... If you visit the National Museum, you know the famous gold boat from Brighter, County Derry, in the north of Ireland? Well, that's a boat of offering of around the time of our Lord, or slightly before. And it represents an ocean-going, masted ship with a high covering. Now, the Romans had a different kind of ship to that. Then the Vikings are not the inventors of the clinker-built boat. You know the clinker-built boat that we find in the Viking excavations, where the planks are nailed onto one another as a kind of a loose skin that's then fixed on to a fixed frame. That's the Viking system of shipping. That's a Germanic ship of about the 4th century, from at least the end of the Roman period. And if you visit the National Museum in Copenhagen, you will see ships of that kind from the late Roman Iron Age. So the Vikings did not invent those wonderful tinkerbell ships. Do you remember the sea stallion from Glendalough that the Danish government brought over to show us in Dublin, which was actually built in Dublin, the original of that, in about the 1060s. But it's a Germanic idea. The Frisians, those great, great precursors of the Vikings in northern Netherlands, those and the people on the Rhine and up into Jutland, like the Nieuwdam Wreck. It's a famous shipwreck, I'd say about here, 450, 500. They all have Viking-type ships. Now, we did not belong to that. That's a Germanic tradition of shipbuilding. We did not have that in Ireland. The Vikings introduced shipbuilding with the way I described, and that was taken over wholesale by the Irish. And, you know, you read now, back to the historical resources, you read about fleets of ships on Loch Ree. The Shannon Estuary was crawling, covered with ships all around Skagway Island. Brian Boru had a fleet out there of his own. That's all very well published now. Cathy, yourself, you published something on this.
But Pat, can I ask you though?
Is that an answer for that?
Yeah, no, it does. But yeah. But would it be true to say though that they did introduce innovations? See, what I'm going to get at here is
once Vikings.
The Vikings,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, all the words in Irish for ships and parts of ships are all lost.
But the point of getting onto is once Brian Boru has control of Limerick, he has control of the fleet. That gives him a military reach throughout the whole length of the country, presumably.
Yes.
I took the boat trip with Una's commentary earlier, and of course, once you get up into Loch Derg there, the whole country is your oyster,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And it meant then that you know, a Viking ship with 100 warriors on it, it's like an Exocet missile, presumably, if it lands suddenly in your neighbourhood.
Oh, you're gone.
Without warning.
You're gone.
But can I ask, and I'm asking the audience here now, because one of the things you become conscious of when you live in Limerick is that Limerick is the first place, as you're coming up the estuary, where you're getting Carrigaroe, you're getting these shoals, you're getting massive... it was very important for the fisheries because the land was the river was shallow at that point. Now, what that made it good for fishing, but it also meant you had to portage around the island. Do you have to portage... I don't know enough about it now because of Ireland and Prussia. Do you have to portage all the way up to Killaloe? How navigable is the Shannon south of Killaloe? Does anybody know?
Portage means you have to hand carry the ships.
Yeah. You don't use the microphone, just say
it. Sorry, yeah, no.
Just hold it right up there.
Yeah, yeah. It all depends on your draft. I mean, if you flood the winter, you fly it.
Right.
But getting up is difficult enough. There was a canal built, it was never a commercial success. So, yes and no. I mean, you wouldn't sort of say on a Sunday, look, I'm going to go up to Killaloe for the day. You'd probably have to pull and drag and pull and drag. But, you know, it all depends on the boat. I mean, if you have your seagoing, I don't know what a seagoing Viking launch ship draws, but I mean, if it draws 10, 15, 12 inches, you should be able to.
It's only 4 feet.
Oh, well, you wouldn't get up to 4 feet. I mean,
that's the draft of a Viking ship.
Yeah, but they would probably find that they would, to get up here, like for instance the railway here,
yeah,
was the head of the railway was here, so there were ships large barges, sailing barges on the Shannon, so the stuff came as far as Killaloe, then it was transshipped onto a train and sent down to Limerick. So I would assume if the Vikings were coming up here, there could be a fleet here, you know, that you get up and you get onto your bigger ones or up there. But once you get to Killaloe, the world is, you know, there was a ford which was removed when they were doing Ireland Prussia at Brian Boru's fort. So that was actually a crossing point, and there was one here, I think, too, as well. I'm holding me 100% on that.
Well, again, when you look at the evidence for the land between here and Limerick, there's a place name, for example, Tua Cymni, which occurs in that stretch. But when we talk about anybody using the Shannon, I'm very conscious that we tend to assume that the boats are simply going into the river at King John's Castle and sailing happily up to here. And in fact, that's what a lot of our texts say. But it's really interesting that it doesn't seem to work.
I'm just going to say Kinkora itself, of course, is the head of the weir. So there was also a weir at the crossing point, and weirs need shallow water. the head of a weir probably suggested it was a V-shaped weir, you know, so you have that thrown into the mix with the ford at Kincorr as well, so, and the turn in the river. So there is a problem, all right, with assuming that you can sail up.
Well, maybe the Limerick Vikings, because the Limerick Vikings were using the lake, so maybe they had a fleet up here, which makes Brian Roo's growth to power even more interesting.
Now, is this a, yeah, use the mic there again, yeah.
Just a local question, as regarding Mungret, I was going to direct it at Pat. Just downstream from the Viking settlement in Limerick was the very substantial monastery of Mungret. And even after the Vikings had settled in Limerick in the 920s, there's no recorded attack on the monastery by the Vikings. There was an earlier one, 834. But for a long, long period of time, Mungret seems to have coexisted peacefully with the Viking settlement. And in 951, apparently, is the date of the Viking Age hoard, which was found near the monastery and very close to the river. So I was just would like Pat's opinion as to the sort of relationship that there existed between the Viking settlement of Limerick and the monastic site, which was equally as large, maybe even larger, just a little downstream. And Mungret was apparently the chief church of the Ifigentic. So it raises a whole lot of questions. I'm just wondering if Pat had any suggestions as to what that relationship might have been.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think your initial hunch is correct, that the Vikings got into a kind of a peaceful coexistence with some of the... That happened certainly in Dublin with, say, monasteries like Clondalkin, as far as I know, Glasnevin, and sites, Christian sites around Dublin, and I suspect Mungret also would be the same vis-a-vis Limerick. What's very interesting for me about Limerick is the date you mentioned there, because we have a very famous silver hoard from Mungret with coins and with weights of hex silver, which tie into the national weight system of, you know, the bullion control done by the Vikings. So Mungret was definitely tied into the Viking economy, I suggest.
Now, I just want to move the discussion on a slightly different direction, John, because this has been mentioned in the last contribution. This is the whole question of the church. Just talk to me a bit about Brian Boru's relationship with the church, because he seemed to have quite a nuanced, you know, relationship and understanding of, you know, how to use it to his advantage.
Yes, I mean, I suppose nowadays we tend to think of the church as being, I don't know if there's any clergy, men or women present, but, you know, it's not exactly at the centre of things. Whereas in the Middle Ages it was, the church, you know, tended to dominate things to a large extent. It was a very political church in Ireland. So all of these kingdoms, earlier I was talking about all of the local kingdoms in Ireland, every one of them had its own church at its heart, usually the things that we usually call monasteries. And they had their own bishops in there, and several of the top churches vied with each other for primacy. But local kings, because they patronized their local church, that was what they considered to be the primatial church. So you had Kildare belonging to the kings of Leinster, for instance, and the great church of the Oganacht we talked about earlier of Munster was Emly, and the Emir who dominated Ireland had Armagh as their church. Now, you would have thought Brian Boru, coming from Munster, he would have had nothing to do with all that because it was associated with the Emir. But of course, he was trying to take their place and to make himself king over all Ireland. So one of the things that's very noticeable about him throughout his career, and I think it's there in the family even before Brian comes on the scene, his brother Matt Cogan, whom Pat mentioned earlier, has a connection with Armagh even before Brian succeeds him. But throughout his life, and especially after he becomes High King, Brian is closely connected with Armagh. And I think basically this is a statement. He's saying, look, I am the new king of all Ireland, and I need a church for all Ireland. So he allies himself with Armagh. And he's scratching the abbot of Armagh's back and the abbot is scratching his back, and they have a kind of a mutual symbiosis going there. And it's very noticeable whenever Brian is up in on these military campaigns to try to get the kings of Ulster to submit to him, he regularly visits Armagh. And on one of these occasions, the Book of Armagh, which survives in Trinity, if you ever go to see the Book of Kells, they have it and the Book of Armagh on display. And the Book of Armagh, for historians, is much more important than the Book of Kells. Because the Book of Kells, I was going to say it's only a set of the Gospels, but it is the Gospels. There's a million copies of the Gospels. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
The Book of Armagh has got is a big collection of early materials relating to St. Patrick. And it's very, very important historically. And so it was brought out on the altar on one of Brian's visits, probably the one in 1005, and this inscription was written into it, in which he agreed to Armagh's claim to basically to go around collecting cattle by way of tax around the country. But that's the description in which he calls himself, or his secretary calls him, Imperator Scotorum, Emperor of the Scoti. The Scots, which is the Irish, if you like, you know, the main, the Romans, the Scots, of course, as you know, are just cousins of the Irish. And the main term the Romans used for Ireland was Scotia, and they called the Irish Scoti. So Brian was claiming to be emperor of all the Gaels. It might have included not just the Irish, but the Irish of Scotland. There's some, you know, limited evidence for his connection.
How significant is that description, or is that just propaganda? Yeah, Imperator Scotorum.
Well, I mean, this is a once-off thing, so it just occurred once. But I think, you know, there might be something attaching to it. I mean, the Cogabale Regale, which is this great account of Brian's life, admittedly written a couple of generations later, but it describes him campaigning in Scotland and getting the submission of some kings in northern Britain. And, of course, when he died at the Battle of Clontarf, one of the men who died fighting for him was the Mormaer, the great steward, the term is normally used for an earl in Scotland, of a place called Mar, which is over in Aberdeenshire, on northeastern Scotland, fought at the Battle of Clontarf alongside the King of Munster, and gave his life for Brian Boru, which suggests that he was one of these, and in fact he is listed along with the Irish kings who died in the battle, as if he was one of them. So there's some evidence for Brian's connections with Scotland throughout his life. And of course, Armagh was very closely associated with Armagh. It was like an ecclesiastical centre for the north of Ireland and for parts of Scotland as well. So there might be something to it. And that term Imperator is important also, because he didn't call himself Rex Hiberni or anything like that. He called him Imperator. Now it's probably just below me, you know, just waffle, but it seems to suggest
it's an
ordinary king. He was king, the king of kings, if you like. That's what an emperor is. And so Ireland would continue to have kings under Brian, but he was the king of kings, the Imperator.
Yeah, and if you look at the Life of St. Flannan, which is written long after Brian's opening period, so you have to wonder, does it become part of the family tradition? But in that is pushing very strongly the notion that O'Briens are emperors, and that Killaloe is a centre of both church. And I mean, one of the interesting things, in Brian's own day, there isn't a massive church. That his family relatives are associated with Killaloe, they're associated with Holy Island, they're associated with Terry Glass. But Killaloe isn't sort of said to be the magnificent, the equivalent of Armagh, the only church. Tungrani is another one. There seems to be a number of different churches. But by the time you get to the Life of St. Flannan, it's very clear that Killaloe is the major church, and it's being described. Aubrey Gwynne was very keen on this, that the Bishop of Killaloe is related to the royal family, O'Briens, and that the two of them have a sort of modelling their power on the Etonian, the Holy Roman Emperors. So again, there's this tradition of using the terminology of imperialism.
Pat, I want to bring you in here, because we've tried to avoid this as long as possible, but it is the millennium, the Battle of Clontarf, and it is located in and around Dublin. How important was Viking Dublin, both economically, politically, at this time?
It was hugely important, and we know that we can crystallise that by the very fact that the economic signal for the arrival of Dublin as a major place of commerce came in 995, 997, about 2 years, when Dublin set up its own coinage. This was a milestone in the economic history of Dublin. Now, we had silver. Silver was the medium of exchange for going way back to the beginning of the Viking Age, but getting more and more prevalent around the year 920, 950. And then gradually, so much commerce and business and exchange is going on, in Dublin particularly, that the Dublin Vikings are using English coins. And they use English coins minted largely in Chester, but minted all over England really. And we found 27 of those in my excavations in Woodkey. And we were able to do a survey of those to show the parts of England that were doing commerce with Ireland. Mark Blackburn, a great numismatist, coin expert, who died about 2 years ago, worked out from our coins that the Viking Dubliners were actually coin-using people. And not only that, the establishment of our own coinage, which is an exact copy, by the way, of English coinage at the time, showed that there was a close connection between the economy of Ireland, the Irish Sea, the Isle of Man, Cumbria, and the West Country. That Dublin was the controlling economic capital of that entire area. And this is only 997. Now you've got 995. You've got to roll on 20 years of intense use, Dolly phase one in terms of coinage. You've got to see the moneyers being brought in from England, the dimes being brought in. By the way, the Vikings in Dublin were mostly illiterate, because the people, they didn't mind the coinage being spelled wrongly. But mind you, the word Rex, King of Dublin, and I take Sean's point fully about Emperor at all. That was a serious title, I suspect, because that was the King of Kings. But the King of Dublin, the man in charge of Dublin, was styled King by himself and recognised as such with his coins across the Irish Sea. So, by the way, the Battle of Tartuffe, 1014, when the Dubs, who very smartly and very necessarily stayed out of that battle, survived, it was a bit like the Japanese and the Germans after the Second World War. They then had a boom economy. They flung all their attempts into developing business, commerce, the hire of their fleet, their mercenary fleet, links with the Saxon Normans, an enormous kind of whoosh of economic activity, which in 1028 culminated or was related, associated with the introduction and building from Cologne and from the continent of the first cathedral in Dublin, the official Christianization of Dublin. So, Tommy, this is a long-winded answer. I'm just saying, I'm giving you the gradual whoosh of economic takeoff, right, of Dublin and the part of Clontarf in that.
Do you want to come in there very quickly?
Yeah. One, two. Thank you. I defended Raflu in my life.
What can I do?
I defended Raflu with my life up in Tara. And I have two questions that's been irritating me for years. One was, where did Brian Brook come from? Did he come to, who came down from Tara related to him? Was it his parents or blah, blah, blah? But where did Brian Brook come from? Like that's my interest. But getting back to that question, what you're talking about coins there.
Yeah.
Was the first Viking to come to around Killaloe, Brian Brook's friend, because Sean Kearse told me he was. And I heard potential
more. Would you like to answer me without that thing in your mouth?
Yeah, thank you. Did Brian Brew bring coins to Ireland?
To Ireland?
No, the Vikings.
Around here.
We do have coins from around here, yeah.
What?
We do have coins from around here. I've had the same period as Brian Brew. We have Canute coins from the Abbey River in Limerick.
Yeah,
and we've got two at Bale the Roo, but they're later.
Yeah, but I mean, no, Brian Brew did not bring coins around here. It was the Scandinavians brought coins. to this part of Ireland, and to Ireland in general.
Thanks very much. I just move on to you, Sean, because Pat's painted a picture there of Dublin becoming an economic powerhouse, right? Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me, given Brian Boru's broad strategic vision, then that meant that was a place he had to control, right? Mm-hmm. Now, it also strikes me that he was very cautious about going into battle, fought very few battles. So why did the Battle of Clontarf take place? That's what I'm getting up to. So why did he have to make his move when he did?
Yeah, I mean, it's very noticeable in Brian's career. I mean, he did spend a lot of attention to the towns, trying to get control of the towns. I mean, we hardly hear a thing of Limerick in this period at all, and I think that's because he enjoyed very good relations with Limerick, and he might even have had a house in Limerick and, you know, ruled in Limerick. And we also hear of him marching early on in his career on Waterford and against control of Waterford. He seems to have dominated it as well. Cork is a minor player, I don't know if you heard of that, I don't know if there's anyone from Cork here, but at this point it was relatively insignificant, it seems, just to, on the basis of the historical evidence, whatever about the archaeological evidence. But it was quiescent, if you like, under Brian as well. So then in the latter years, when he was trying to push his way throughout all of Ireland, Dublin was the next great target. And he got control of Dublin on New Year's Eve in the year 999. I don't know what you were doing on New Year's Eve in 1999, as the millennium was looming. Brian wasn't having a party. He had a battle, he fought a battle at a place called Glen Morma. We're not sure where that is, but somewhere on the approach to Dublin from Munster. And that was a success for him, and he stormed it the next day, and he gained control of Dublin. And then you see it, if you look in the Irish annals, when they describe Brian's campaigns, and they list the forces in his army, they always list the Dublin fleet as being part of his forces. So he was able to use Dublin, its financial resources that Pat was talking about, its military resources, its great army. The Vikings, of course, were superbly armoured, whereas the Irish tended... Geraldus Cambrensis, when he writes about it, describes the Irish running naked into battle. I'm not sure if they were trying to scare the enemy away, but I presume naked means they didn't have armour to much extent. But obviously, Dublin's great fleet as well is at its disposal, and so he's able to campaign right the way up to the northernmost parts of Ireland and force the northern kings one by one to submit to him, using Dublin. And Dublin stays under his control for the rest of his life, really, just until the previous year to 1014, sometime in 1013, there's a rebellion against Brian. And it's led by this man, this king of Dublin, that Pat was talking about, the famous Sitric Silkenbeard, and in alliance with the king of Leinster at that stage, the two of them rebel against Brian. And really, the Battle of Clontarf is Brian Boru's attempt to put down this rebellion against him and to regain control of Dublin. Because I think his claim to be king of all of Ireland would have been worthless if Dublin wasn't under his control. That's how central Dublin was to Irish affairs at that stage.
But one of the really interesting things, seems to me, about the Battle of Clontarf, because we talk a lot about, say, Limerick and Viking wealth fueling Brian's growth to power. But if you look at the people who are listed as fighting for Brian at the Battle of Clontarf, there's no mention of Limerick, and there's no, but there is mention of people from West Clare. And one of the things about that, when Brian does fight battles earlier on, is we have at least some references which suggest that he does a pincer movement. He has people on boats and he has people on land. But at Clontarf, we really see him on land. We don't see him with a fleet, and yet he has people from Kilkee and Kilrush and that area who are famous in O'Brien poetry of the day as providing shipping and as using shipping. So one of the things about Clontarf and one of the mysteries about Clontarf is we have this fantastic account of Cogadh Mhaire Ó Gualadh, which is a magnificent story. But the question is, to what extent is it a story, and to what extent there are parts of the battle that we're just not seeing, that haven't been recorded. And I think the whole issue of sea power may be one of them.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is obviously, this is a crucial issue. We use this text all the time because, you know, you have to use what you have available. And the Cote d'Ivoire Regala views, as Kathy was saying, it is more a work of literature than a work of history.
When has it been translated?
Well, the latest research by a man called Dennis Casey suggests it might have been written around 1080 or thereabouts. So if you think of,
And published, written where?
Where has he published this article?
No.
Where was it written?
No, it's in your book.
We don't know where it was written. I suspect it was written somewhere down this part of the world. I mean, it might even be written in Limerick, because there's little bits of Norse in it, and it's possible there's some kind of connection. But certainly, it originates in this general part of the world, the Dáil Gáis area that was subject to Dáil Gáis. But if it was written about 1080, and you'd imagine people in Ireland at that period, a man might have fought, you know, in his mid-teens. So you could have an 80-year-old who fought at the Battle of Clontarf, even if he's only carrying someone else's weapons, still alive to tell the story.
I remember, with the audience on the day. This is a retrospective justification for Professor Duffy's brilliant book, which was written published earlier. This year, a large round Easter there. And in fact, you finally found the link, the missing link with Casey's work. Because in that book, which
he says this in the book as well.
No, he doesn't use that 1080 gauge.
Oh, he does?
Oh, no, he doesn't.
Oh, yes. But I mean, the point is that it's literature, but you have to sift through it and try and find where the truth is. But insofar as it can be tested against other evidence, it's remarkably consistent with other evidence. So you have to sometimes give something the benefit.
Before we argue about the evidence, right? I'd say there's people in the audience might like to know what happened.
Or
to what extent can we kind of speculate or you know? So give us your party piece on the Battle of Clontarf. No, very broad strokes.
Well, I mean, there is a wide range of evidence for it, it sure has to be said. I mean, the Irish annals have accounts of it. They tend to be fairly brief, and the ones that are very lengthy, you have to be suspicious of, I think. There is a Cote d'Ivoire Regala. It occurs, though, even there are references to it in chronicles that are written in Wales, a chronicle that's written down in the south of France, actually has an account of the Battle of Clontarf. It might be the closest to contemporaneity. It seems to have been written around 1020 or thereabouts, this chronicle that has a detailed account of the battle. Its evidence is a bit confused, but it's interesting and it's relatively consistent with the other material. And then, of course, the Viking sagas have lots of material on the Battle of Clontarf, most of which is rubbish and written hundreds of years later, and they just have to be. To dismiss it. But if you put it all together and you look at the bits that are in common with them, I mean, it seems to me that it's all to do with this rebellion against Brian by the King of Dublin, primarily. All of the accounts emphasise the primacy of Brian's Dublin enemies. So I sometimes read nowadays that basically the Battle of Clontarf was a petty interprovincial grudge match between the King of Munster and the King of Leinster, and that the Vikings are irrelevant to the thing, and that's all later legend. But I don't see that in the contemporary sources. The contemporary sources see it primarily as a contest between Brian, who is King of Ireland, and people, opponents who are primarily Scandinavian by extraction. So it is, in that sense, an Irish-Scandinavian struggle. And Brian, there is some evidence, I think, that it is, you know, to look at Clontarf, you need to look at it on a bigger scale as well. Because we sometimes forget here in Ireland to look at things that are happening elsewhere at exactly the same time. And if you look at our neighbours in England, the Anglo-Saxons, under the famous Ethelred the Unready, the King of England, you might have heard of, were conquered literally months before the Battle of Clontarf by the Danes under the family of the famous King Canute. First of all by his father, King Sweyn Forkbeard, and then King Canute succeeds him subsequent to that. So it's an extraordinary coincidence that England should be conquered months before the Battle of Clontarf, and that you have this major confrontation taking place in Dublin at Easter 1014. I think, therefore, that there are forces at work among Brian's enemies at Clontarf, who are trying to do to Ireland what they were able to do fairly successfully for a while in England at that stage, who thought that they might be able to come here and at least gain some territory for themselves here. Now, you can't prove that, but I do think it is not a local, petty, interprovincial. It's a major event, and Brian's opponents are primarily Scandinavian, even if there are Irish levies in their forces, and the King of Leinster is one of them, who is related to the King of Dublin at that stage.
But the other thing is, I think also, that Brian is old at this stage. I mean, he's either in his 70s or in his 80s. But Sean and I have had this argument before. There are people who are looking to the future. And as Sean said, the rebellion did start off with the rebellion by the Dublin Kings. A lot of the Irish powers are looking to what's going to happen when Brian eventually shuffles off his mortal coil. And that's part of why the rebellion happens and part of why Clontarf happens. I absolutely agree. I think Sean's done a magnificent job in sort of highlighting the international context. But I think there's also an Irish context of guys who are saying, okay, kingship works by allying myself with the most powerful king around. The most powerful king around is now in late old age. He can no longer fight. He goes to the Battle of Clontarf and he spends it fighting for his side by praying, by imitating King David. And we have to, as proper politicians and leaders of our own peoples, we have to keep an eye on what's going to happen. And I think that's part of the Irish context, which feeds into why the battle becomes important.
But you think in view of some of Sean's theories?
Yes, I do, but the more Sean knows his view, the more I like it, but I still don't think he's right. Let me explain. The Danes conquered England in 1013, and but I feel that the axis which allowed them to do that was a North Sea Danish axis. The real Viking leader was a man whose name we haven't mentioned yet. And was Sigurd, the Earl of the Orkneys. Now, he was the one, Sigurd the Stout. He was a wonderful man, a man who had some links with Christian Ireland. His mother was from the dynasty of Oswy in South Kilkenny. But he was promised the hand of Gormr, that much married woman. A Walish woman. If he came to Dublin to fight for Brian Boru or to fight for Sifri, he was promised by Sifri. Gormr was the mother of Sifri. So Sifri went over after that Christmas when the clairmen went home for Christmas, which was a mistake. If Gerlach Graham had been in charge, it wouldn't have happened. So the Clare boys went home for Christmas, and it gave the Dubs a chance to regroup, and the King of Dublin, Sifri, who's a great hero of mine, by the way, he went to the Orkneys. Now, the Orkneys was a very purish Scandinavian place, with this Earl Sigurd the Stout in charge. Earl Sigurd said, look, I'll come over, and we'll rope in the lads from the Isle of Man and Cumbria, and we'll come over. But he was offered the hand of Sifri's mother. For God's sake, I mean, we're not talking Kate Blanchett or somebody here. We're talking about a very elderly person.
Excuse me.
Fairly elderly person. Well, I know this is sexist, but it's the reality of the time. Who comes over? Sifri, our Sigurd of the Orkneys. He's the man. Now, his axes of connection into
he's
the
late 50s by this day.
Who?
He's in his late 50s.
A great old man he was. But his links are up into Norway, the Norse world, the islands, the Faroes, the Shetlands. That's his axis. It's a completely different axis to the axis in London, and that's where I think, Sean, there's still that tiny division between the two of us, because I see Eric Seeger and his art as very important, and not the Danes.
Yep. I tell you, I want to move on here, right, guys, because I don't have the time, right? And it seems to me in some ways that, okay, Brian Marie is killed at the Battle of Clontarf, but in a sense, that's when his life really begins, his afterlife. Yeah. Because by the 17th, 18th century, you have these depictions of Brian Boru with the crown on his head, which we reproduced almost exactly on the cover of our special issue earlier this year, because that's the only image of Brian Boru there is. But Sean, that's a very significant image. You know, the image of Brian Boru with the scepter in his hand, the crown on his head, and it's reproduced right up into the 20th century Christian Brother textbooks and so on. Yeah. What's the basis for this, and what's its significance?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, Tommy, because that occurs in a book that was published in, I think, 1722, which is an English language translation of Geoffrey Keating's Horas Spasa Errorum, you know, that magnificent book, which is a history of Ireland, you know, going back to prehistory, and history and mythology of Ireland. And so it's a huge compendium of Irish history that Keating put together. And when this English language translation was published in the early 18th century, and they wanted a frontispiece, you know, kind of a nice picture for the title, beside the title page there. So of all the places in Ireland they might have picked, or all the objects they could have used, or all the characters they might have used, they picked Brian Boru. And that, you know, it's a very significant one, because obviously by that stage, he was it. You know, if you were writing the history of Ireland and you want to sum it up in one person, you choose Brian Boru, which is, you know, it's precisely for the same reason that the harp that's in Trinity College, which is our national symbol that's on our coins and on the presidential ensign and all the rest of it, is called Brian Boru's harp, because you couldn't, you couldn't think of giving it any other name, because he became archetypically Irish. He is the thing that sums up Ireland and Irish people. That's why I'm so delighted that there has been so much happening in 2014.
For Ireland, you know that beautiful Brian Boru march, which Jimmy Galway played at the Whelan concert. Mm-hmm. Is that a Carolan composition?
No, I don't think it is a Carolan competition, but it was the first composition. It was first published in the mid-19th century, the sheet music for it. And it was said at that stage to be considerably older, but I don't think it has associations with the Carolan. But it's one of the first Irish melodies to become the best seller internationally, the sheet music, you know, at a time when sheet music was starting to take off. So it's significant from that. But again, obviously, it has nothing to do with Brian Boru, but they wanted to associate it with some great martial figure from Ireland's past, and Brian is the man.
But if I can refer to the research of Lenore Fisher from Mount Shannon, one of the things that she has done is to say that one of the interesting things about Clontarf and about Brian is that although Brian became a symbol, for nationalist Ireland very much in the 19th and 20th centuries, there was always these sort of tripartite division about the Battle of Clontarf in terms of, was Mail Shocknell really key and the Enail? Was Brian really key, or was he an upstart and fading at the time? And the third item, which I think is really interesting and in a way is reflected in our panel, was Dublin the key element in the whole story of Clontarf? And she really emphasises the idea that Dubliners constantly went back to the story of Clontarf as part of their mercantile economic history and power base as a centre for Ireland. So although we might emphasize Brian at the expense of the other two, what Lenore has shown is that there was always, in the historiography, there was always this tripartite element to it.
Cathy, I just want to go back to you one question here. And this is, again, Brian in his afterlife, and him being depicted as this, you know, soldier of Christ, you know, with the allegedly going amongst his troops, the crucifix, whatever, mm-hmm. which we can take with a grain of salt. You said to me that there was something like 150 psalms.
Ah, I'm so proud of this. Yeah.
Tell us about this. And you've actually You've actually done them. 6 hours to receive. You've actually done a marathon.
Yeah.
Tell us more.
Well, okay, maybe Niordle at Sean's conference, she pointed out that Brian as holding the crucifix, as sort of rallying the troops before Clontarf, is really a feature of post-penal penal laws. And it's sort of a revival of Catholic nationalist Ireland from the 1830s on. But in Cogha, so our earliest source, Brian is said to have recited during the time of the during the duration of the Battle of Clontarf, he recited 150 psalms, the entire Psalter. And this is, I was intrigued by this because this is also something which churchmen of the day were supposed to do. The Ceilidh Dé, for example, in their rule, they're supposed to go into the church and recite the entire Psalter. And I wanted to know, Sean, in Sean's book, he talks about the calculations done about the tides and that the battle took 12 hours. And I was just ferociously curious about how long it takes to recite 150 psalms in Latin. And we did this as a sponsorship in Mary Eye. And I can tell you, it takes me, anyway, and whatever it took Brian, 6 hours, okay, sure. Non-stop. But no, sorry, there was one toilet break in the middle.
For you or for Brian?
For me. But the really interesting thing is that 75 psalms, which is half the number of psalms, takes 3 hours. And 100 psalms, which is two-thirds of the entire total, takes 4 hours. So it's a really intriguing. I mean, we don't think of the psalms perhaps enough because when you see them in translation, we don't really hear about them much. But they were really, really important in the medieval church. They were how you learnt to read was through the psalms. And again, in terms of going back to what you were saying about Brian as emperor, I do think the notion that the person who wrote the psalms was King David of Israel. That part of why Brian spends the battle doing this is to reinforce this notion of him as the Christian supreme king.
I was going to use the word caliph there.
yeah, fair enough. Okay.
Well, it's applicable, possibly. Mm. Do you recommend that part?
I'm amazed and impressed with Cassie. Not for the first time, I say. But just as we're here in Clare, there's two things, and we should realise where we are in County Clare. First of all, one wonders what was the topography of Killaloe like at the time of Brian Boru. Was Brian Boru up and running? Where was King Cora? We have the wonderful piece of sculpture with the Old Norse runes and the Gaelic Torgrim, is it Torgrim? In Killaloe Cathedral, which is definitely, I mean, is probably of is that of the 1100s?
It's around 1100, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you'd have to really stretch yourself to try. But Killaloe must have been an amazingly important place. But we haven't treated it well archaeologically. Now, that's not the fault of Clare County Council or of archaeology as a subject. It's more or less got to do with the rushed way the Shannon scheme did everything fast here. Around here in the 20s, I think. Because really, Killaloe should be monitored very carefully. And while I'm on that subject, I want to suggest that Cathy might be wrong about her references to West Clare. You mentioned that you mentioned Kilrush and Kilkee by name.
Mm-hmm.
They were not in existence at the time.
Of
Brian Boru, number one. And number two, were you thinking of the Kirkabaskin?
I was.
Well, they're farther up the coast.
Well, no, they control everywhere from the River Fergus down to the bottom of Loop Head and then over to.
I thought they went up towards the Burn.
That's the Kirkham Rood.
The
Kirkham Rood,
yeah.
Kirkham Row, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you divide the coast of Clare sort of halfway down, you have the Corkabashkin getting halfway up.
Right. So it might be neither football nor hurling, but surfing.
I'm just
conscious of the time, and I just want to go find one last time to the audience. I know you jumped in early, many people anyway, which is great. Use the radio mic so we can hear you.
I just want to ask a question. What happened to the Brian Boru dynasty after he died?
Yeah, well, it's a good question because you know, they went on to bigger and better things in some senses after Brian died. I mean, it was unfortunate for Brian that he was killed in the battle, and his intended heir was killed in the battle. And his intended heir's intended heir was killed in the battle. His son and his grandson were killed. So there were two younger sons who were left, Donacha and Tadhg, and you had the usual kind of a squabble between the two of them to see who would succeed. And Donacha initially succeeded. So he became king of Ireland, Donacha Mac Brian. And he's the man I told you earlier that died in Rome in 1064 after he had been banished and lost the kingdom. And then the children of his brother Tadhg were starting to come of age then at that stage. But because they were Mac Tadhg, so they were Ua Brian, which of course is literally the grandson of Brian, but they started in the family, it became fossilized at that stage as a surname, the O'Brien surname. So, I mean, in theory, everyone on the planet who is called O'Brien is one of these Ibrian, these descendants of Brian Boru. And so, obviously, they continued to rule Thomond for centuries after that. And, you know, there's Conor O'Brien out in Inchiquin or in Dromoland or one of these places still around to this day, you know, they're descendants of O'Brien. And, of course, there were other collateral lines of the family, if you like, who continued to retain power. I mean, one of Brian's nephews was Kinnaird, had the same name as Brian's father, so he is the ancestor of the O'Kennedys. So they continued. Bertie Ahern's ancestors are descended from one of Brian's brothers, I think, and so on. The O'Lonergans and so on, they're descended from a brother, a collateral line of Brian as well. So once they got their hands on power, under Brian and his brother, they held on to it, and they dominated this part of the world until the Middle Ages.
And there's, can I suggest there's a legacy issue from this year, maybe? There's a girl who abandoned history to become a tax lawyer called Aoife Ní Gilleadh. And she did a magnificent study of the O'Briens in the beginning of the 14th century and the Battle of Cork and Roe. And actually, that were because she abandoned history, unfortunately. She was a very gifted historian. But if we could... I don't think there's one article that I know of in CMCS, but it's not widely known. If we could emphasize her research and bring the story of the O'Briens, you know, try and fill in the story of O'Brien's descendants and perhaps add something to the Heritage Centre, just to build up the story of Brian. So it's not just Brian himself, but it's the family. I think that would be a great way of marking the year that's in it.
Una, you wanted to come in there?
Just
get the mic.
Pat sort of touched on this a few moments ago when he mentioned the lack of excavations in the area. So do you just want to talk about maybe the importance of Kinkora? We're only a stone's throw away from it here. You know, we don't have evidence from archaeological excavations, but we do have some information from the annals and that. So do you want to talk about that? Well, and maybe the importance of Béal Barú as well.
Well, I was going to ask you, Una, or maybe local people here, but I'd love to know, I mean, what is the origin of the belief that Kinkora, the Palace of Kinkora, stood on the grounds of the Catholic Church here in Killaloe?
I suppose part of it would be just the location of it, the highest point in the town.
Right.
And right above the river, Kinkora, Kiancora, the Irish of it, means
the
head of the Weir.
But it's the head of the Weir, so should it not be near a Weir? I mean, it was interesting was telling me this, putting this point to me, and I hadn't thought of it, you know, that it should be somewhere closer to this, quite a bit away from the river.
I think Lindsay, with the mic there, should I bring Lindsay in there maybe? Yeah, we're coming down with expertise here this evening.
Not at all. No, I think it's the Ordnance Survey letters that Donovan says that it was traditionally the site of it. That's really the origin, I think, of it. And but he actually comments in the letters that there's no sign of the fort in any of the field boundaries. He's not casting aspersions on it. He's just saying you can't see it. So there was nothing there in the mid-19th century. So it could be the case that we are looking in kind of the wrong place, because the place name does suggest that it's in line with the weir, the head of the weir, which, as I said earlier, was probably a V-shaped weir in shallow water. And so it could be further, slightly further upstream.
Yeah, but they're shaking their heads down.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. Shake your heads.
They are convinced. I'm just looking at the time here, guys.
But it was definitely here. It was definitely here in Killaloe, that's for sure.
It must have had something to do with the weir, whereas the Catholic Church in Killaloe is a hell of a long way from the river.
Wait, sorry, just let this man ask him in before. No, use the microphone, you won't be, because this is being recorded, I won't hear you otherwise.
At the northern side of the Catholic Church, when you stand on the top of the Isle Vaughan, as youngsters, when there were only three cars in the town, right, our favourite pastime was, see how far out could we throw a stone. Now, we were throwing it directly onto where the weir was. So the Catholic Church, the northern side of the Catholic Church, looked straight down, literally, almost vertically, now, on top of the weir. So it is actually very near it.
We'll have to continue this. I'm going to wrap up here, guys. We may bring some of the audience in. Tell you, if you haven't been before, okay. Yeah, just one here.
Just two very quick questions. Was Brian Boru the military strategist himself, or did he have somebody else to do that for him?
It's a difficult one. You'd have to say that he was himself, you know, that he was a very... You know, a very significant figure politically and militarily. Though, as Tommy mentioned earlier, it is the case he fought very few battles. You tend to think of him as being some kind of a warlord who spent his whole life engaged in battles. But if you actually look at the record, he might have fought four, maybe five battles in a very long career, maybe 60-year career. So that is significant. I think he managed to, whatever it was about him, insofar as he was able to win people over to him, he did it fairly silently in military terms. Now, he brought an army with him when he marched, when he campaigned around the country, and he forced people into submission. But he seems to force them into submission without actually having to venture a pitched battle, usually, to do it. So, and that, to me, bespeaks somebody who had very significant political skills. You know, but he is a very significant. I remember reading something fairly recently that said that, you know, in Ireland until 100 years ago or something like that, nobody ever travelled more than 20 miles from the place of birth, something like that. But if you look at Brian Boru's life, he spent most of his life when he was High King, campaigning around the length and breadth of Ireland. I mean, County Donegal, County Derry, County Antrim, County Down. This is where you spend him year after year after year. You see him campaigning there. So he was a national figure, not a local figure.
Yeah, I just in answer to that David's question, a supplementary thought. Andy Halpin, former colleague of mine, is the world's leading expert on arms and armour and that kind of thing, and indeed warfare in Ireland in the 10th and the 11th centuries. All I can say is that we have excellent evidence from the Dublin excavations for the use of chainmail. This is at the time of Clontarf, for the use of armour-piercing arrowheads, which would go straight through that barrel there. I mean, they're terrific things released from arrows. They would go through chainmail. So this is the Vikings with Viking equipment. And they also, the stirrup and the spur and all of that comes in with the same stuff. So you're thinking, how did the Irish do so well with their different equipment, not inferior, but different equipment, dealing with these boys in chainmail and with some horses? Cavalry, I don't know, is the answer to that. It's remarkable that the Irish did so well at battles like Clontarf with their... Now, they were arrow men as well, but the Irish mainly used spears and swords and knives. So I would say the Irish would have been fairly invincible close at hand fighting. But if there was any pre-battle softening up to be done of the opposition, the Vikings had the advantage there with their wonderful arrows. But all that information is non-historical. That's coming up out of the ground in the Viking excavations of Dublin.
But and the other thing, of course, is if we look at the Middle East and Iraq today, I mean, even if Brian only fought a few battles, the great thing is that once he fought them, and they were over.
Mm.
And that's a huge military ability. I mean, you know, that he seems to have managed, whether by marrying off his daughters to locals or whatever stratagem he uses, once he wins the battle, he keeps people calm decades afterwards.
Kathy,
I want to finish up here, because this is important. It leads in what you were saying there, right? Which is, why the continuing fascination with Brian Boru? In other words, why are we here? And should there be a continuing fascination with Brian Boru? Maybe, Sean, your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, he was a very significant figure. He did come from a relatively obscure background. He did push his way all the top to the top. And he did... you know, he did become the first in a succession of Irish high kings in the period from his own life until the Anglo-Norman invasion, who could become high king just by virtue of their own political skills and their military skills. You know, he ushered in a new age, if you like, in Ireland, where the high kingship was open to people. Now, you could argue that was damaging ultimately, because Dermot McMurrough is the man who decided, because he wanted to be high king. Probably had ambitions to that regard. He went outside Ireland and brought the Normans in and changed things forever, in a sense. But he did change the rules of Irish politics. And as we were saying earlier, I have this pet theory that actually, if you think about it, Brian was killed at the Battle of Clontarf. So we shouldn't really regard it as a victory. And yet it has always been regarded as a victory. And it seems to me that's because of what he averted on that day, what he prevented happening. And I suspect this is something to do with contemporary events in England, as we were talking about earlier, and the Danish conquest of England. So that contemporaries regarded him as a success because, if you like, of what he, that negative thing, that he prevented something greater, something awful happening on that day. And so, of course, we all need heroes, and he is... He's about as good as it gets in that.
He'll never be Michael Collins. But anyway, I just mention that facetiously, because Brian Boru, of course, is the great figure up there with, say, Daniel O'Connell and Michael Collins, maybe. But, I mean, don't forget, for every period of our history, we're looking for heroes to justify our stance in the present. At the moment now, we're rapidly trying to see how we can invite the British royal family, lovely people as they turned out to be, but how they can be invited to our 1916 celebrations, which were the 1916 was a minority event within the Ireland of its time. So be very careful, always. I would ask us all to be careful of the construction of heroes and the purpose for the construction of heroes with regard to the present tense. And I think Brian Boru was reinvented of necessity by Chateau and Katie and by other people to justify the struggle against oppression in the early modern period. But he is a hero for all ages. We must be careful. Cathy.
And as a hero for the 21st century, we heard earlier that he was he's encountering the economics of Europe. And he's triumphing over the economics of Europe as represented by the Vikings and creating a new Irish power base. So maybe one of the things about him is that he lived in a time of change, he lived in a time of uncertainty, and he created new structures in that time and a memory that lasted 1,000 years. So maybe he's a hopeful hero for the 21st century.
Just on that, he manifestly did not triumph over the economics of the Vikings. Manifestly.
Well, he took the economics of Limerick and he used them to pay for his army, which he then conquered Dublin with. So I think he triumphed over the Vikings.
Yeah, I'm going to
We haven't agreed on anything yet. So yeah.
Okay,
why should we
one last contribution. If you use the microphone. Yeah. No, wait, microphone. Yeah.
Recently I had occasion to go into Easons, I won't say which one, and I asked them for the most recent book on Brian Boru. There was one published last year, I think. Is that it? And do you know what the fellow said to me in Easons? Was he a footballer?
I can't go home now.
On that note, I'm going to wrap up here. We've had a very, very wide-ranging and interesting discussion, which I'm sure will continue afterwards. I think we're heading to Flanagan's for some tea. You're welcome to tag along.
Speaking of football, isn't there something happening at 9 o'clock? Yeah,